The headlines. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi calls for further cooperation among the Caspian littoral states as he addresses a summit of the regional countries in Turkmenistan. Hundreds of Palestinians gather to mourn a man who was fatally shot by Israeli forces during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Moscow says that NATO summit confirms its policy of aggressive containment of Russia, calling the expansion of the Western military alliance a purely destabilizing factor. Thanks for joining us. The sixth summit of the Caspian Littoral States is underway in Turkmenistan's capital. Leaders of the five participating nations have addressed the event. President Ebrahim Raisi of Iran has said the Caspian Sea provides a context for expanding cooperation among the five bordering countries. He said that Iran seeks to make use of all potentials to boost cooperation. The Iranian president underscored the importance of unanimity in taking any decision about the Caspian Sea. Raisi rejected unilateralism in making decisions for the region. The Iranian president has already met with his Turkmen counterpart. Moscow says a NATO summit in Madrid confirms the military alliance's policy of aggressive containment of Russia. Russia's deputy foreign minister was speaking in response to NATO's chief, Jens Stoltenberg, who said that NATO members will refer to Russia as a, quote, direct threat to their security in a new strategic blueprint set to be unveiled during the summit later today. Sergei Ryabkov said the designation has nothing to do with real life. He said, quote, it is the alliance that poses a threat to us. The summit will also see NATO leaders inviting Finland and Sweden to join the alliance after Turkey dropped objections to the move. Ryabkov has censured it as a destabilizing action. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for more aid from Western countries to help his country's fight against Russia.
Ukraine needs modern missile and air defense systems, and you have these systems. By providing them to us, you can completely wreck Russia's tactics of destroying cities and terrorizing the civilian population of Ukraine.
Zelensky said Russia must be isolated by more sanctions. The Ukrainian president made the remarks during a NATO summit in Madrid. On Monday, Washington announced that it would send sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine. It would be the latest in a series of Western arms shipments to the country. It also pushes the total U.S. aid to Kyiv to over $6 billion since February. Moscow blames the West for prolonging the conflict by sending more weapons. Russia has reportedly warned military aid to Ukraine would only worsen the circumstances and destabilize the region. Johnny Miller is a correspondent who joins us from Donetsk to tell us more about the developments in Ukraine. Well, let's first start with what we just spoke about, which is the summit that NATO has held, Johnny, if you don't mind. And what is very interesting about that is there's no mention really of any setbacks by Ukraine. Of course, there are always talks, it seems like, daily on more military assistance to Ukraine.
Well, Ukraine is currently retreating from Lysychansk and Severodonetsk. The wording has always changed around those. So while in the Western media it's not really called retreating, it's being called a fighting withdrawal, which sounds rather more complimentary to the Ukrainians than a retreat. But the truth is that Russia is going forward. They're taking Lysychansk quicker than expected. They're trying to close behind Lysychansk as well, so many Ukrainians are worried about getting out early before being stuck there. So Russia certainly are advancing. There is, though, I heard one Russian commentator call the potential of the next Ukrainian defensive line, he called it the banana of doom. The reason he did that is because there's a line of Ukrainian cities, Kramatorsk, Slavyansk, all the way down to the strangely named New York, and it sort of curves like that. It's a line of two kind of mid-sized cities and then some large towns. And it looks like that could be a very successful defensive line from the Ukrainians. So while the Russians are going forward, Ukrainians will hope to get some of these new NATO weapons on the field so they can make their last ditch defense along these cities and towns. Maybe it will be the last chance they have to defend the Donbass region.
When you talk about, I mean, you know, we're just trying to understand how the two militaries size up against each other. When you talk about the Ukrainian forces, are we talking about forces that are capable, that are, or are they dwindling in numbers, or is it that because they need weapons that will help them then have an edge over the Russian forces? How do things look in that respect?
Well, it's a bit of both. There was an interesting interview from a commander of the French company, a French media outlet, I think it was, who said that 80% of his original well-trained troops are now dead or severely wounded, and they're having to be replaced with very badly trained troops. Reports are that hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers, the Guardian newspaper said 600 to 1,000 at one point, dying every day. That's a huge amount of loss of life. And while the Ukrainians have many reservists, they're not very well trained. And so I've seen many videos as well of poorly trained Ukrainian soldiers making videos of themselves and posting them online to President Zelensky and saying, we're poorly trained. We're told we'll never have to go to the front line. We haven't even got proper artillery, proper equipment, and we're just being sent in to be used as cannon fodder. And that's very much a sorry tale that's being told on the social networks, on the internet, by Ukrainian soldiers. So it's both. Ukraine is hugely running out of top-class, well-trained soldiers, but it's also lacking in artillery. The Russian army, for example, has been lampooned by the West for many years for stocking up on masses of artillery and huge amounts of artillery rounds. War is fought anymore. But that aim of Russia over many, many years in the Soviet era has proven correct. Russia has got overwhelming artillery superiority, and that's how they're winning this war. By huge artillery bombardment, soldiers simply can't live with. And meanwhile, Ukraine is running out of ammunition, particularly all the Soviet ammunition that isn't made anymore. So they need these new American weapons to get to the front line. Many of them get blown up before they even get there. Some do get to the front line and do some damage, but they just can't compete with the overwhelming Russian artillery at the moment.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Johnny. Johnny Miller there, a correspondent, talking to us from Donetsk. Many thanks. Okay, moving on. Hundreds of Palestinians are mourning the death of a young man who was fatally shot by Israeli forces during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Mohammed Maher Marai succumbed to his injuries in the hospital after he was seriously wounded by regime troops in the Jenin refugee camp. The area has been a flashpoint in recent months. More than 20 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in and around the camp since the beginning of the year. On Tuesday, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the international community to take action to end Israel's violations in the occupied territories. Our correspondent Mona Kandil tells us why the Israeli forces attack the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on an almost daily basis.
As you have mentioned, Mohammed Marai is not the first Palestinian who was killed by the Israeli forces in Jenin. The Israeli military, and according to experts, of course, that in recent months when Palestinians carried out anti-Israel operations, many of them originally came from Jenin area. That's why the Israelis are trying to show the Israelis, and the settlers themselves as well, that the military is not silent, that the Israeli military continue to chase Palestinian, they call terrorists, and raid Jenin area almost on a daily basis.
Elbit Systems, an Israel weapons manufacturer, is being drummed out of the UK. It has already been forced to close down its headquarters in London, and activists are not stopping there. Bianca Rahmi tells us more in this report.
A potential choice for the UK competition, which
Elbit Systems markets its weaponry as battle-tested, and this is what it means. The Gaza Strip has become a showroom for Israel's deadly arms trade. While the death toll is counted, Israel uses footage to advertise its products, signing multi-million dollar contracts as a result. One of its customers is Britain, which also hosts Elbit factories. Palestine Action has successfully closed down its headquarters in London and in Oldham, and is now going after UAV, which makes end for Elbit's military drones. Nestled in the British countryside, a factory producing weapons to be used against the Palestinians in the Middle East. So are the locals aware of what's going on here? The activists protesting here today say yes. And they also say momentum is building across the country in support of Palestine Action.
I think local community, until we started demonstrating here, were not aware what this company is doing. As a result of our protests, a lot more people are learning what this company is doing, and they are not actually supportive of it.
I came back from Bristol not long ago, and I had a Shut Elbit Down T-shirt on, and every child in the housing estate I was walking through started to chant it. They all knew who Elbit was. Now, when I was young, nobody knew really anything about the Palestinian conflict. You know, they didn't really know what was happening.
The protesters also say that as Britons, they have a heightened responsibility to oppose the Israeli entity and fight for the liberation of Palestine.
We created this situation before even Britain had conquered that country. We gave it away to people who didn't live there.
One of the most interesting things, and I don't know if many people know this, the British Parliament in the 30s took a decision that there should be a representative assembly, as they did with their colonial. And that would have been a majority for the Palestinians. And the Labour Party, who were very, very strong supporters of Zionism, objected to that, and it was eventually defeated.
It was found out by, I think, CAT, a campaign against the arms trade, that 164 children died directly from drones made in the UK. And this factory makes drones, makes weaponized drones, which makes them ammunition, which means this is a weapons factory. There's often an argument, are they weapons, are they not? Yes, they are, they're weaponized, and they're classified as munitions. So, yeah, it's got to go.
The UK is said to be using Israeli weapons to stop refugees from reaching its shores. But in Britain, there is a colossal pushback against any cooperation with Tel Aviv. Millions of people regularly march in support of the Palestinian people, calling for an end to apartheid and for Israel to be held accountable for its crimes against humanity. Bianca Rahimi, Shenstone.
Widespread starvation is looming on the horizon as the UN has slashed its funding for the war-ravaged Yemen. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that over 19 million people are going hungry in Yemen. The figure is the highest since the start of the Saudi-led war in the impoverished country. According to the UN Children's Agency, about 2.3 million children also suffer from acute malnutrition, as Yemenis are scrambling to get enough food due to 8 years of Saudi-led war and famine. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The World Food Program currently provides food aid to 13 million Yemenis, but the agency has announced drastic cuts, meaning only 5 million of them will be able to access the assistance. When it comes to human rights, Iran has been on the receiving end of harsh, unfounded allegations of abuse made by Washington. One would ask how a violator of human rights could judge and accuse another country on the same topic, especially when that country, namely the U.S., has been involved in economic terrorism to the point that it has cost Iranian lives.
Iran is marking American Human Rights Review and Exposure Week, which runs from June the 27th till July the 3rd, which aims to highlight U.S. human rights violations towards the Iranian people. In a statement for this occasion, Iran's foreign ministry has released a report highlighting the U.S. violations of the rights of the Iranian people. One of the most blatant U.S. atrocities against the Iranian people is the economic terrorism the U.S. regime is committing through different sanctions.
I think what's interesting is that it should even come up that other countries have the right to bring the same charges against the United States that the United States has been using to sanction and punish and invade and occupy, to be honest, countries for the last 75 years. I think it makes sense for others to raise the issue of U.S. human rights violations.
Iran says U.S. unilateralism and imposition of unilateral economic sanctions with the aim of forcing governments to change their policies is a gross and systematic violation of human rights. It further highlights the fact that the imposition of unilaterally coercive sanctions by the United States has become a tool for violating the natural and legal rights of the Iranian people, including the right to life, the right to health, the right to adequate living standards, the right to education, and access to knowledge and technology. The Foreign Ministry report also touched on some of the repercussions of the sanctions, saying they had endangered food security, led to the non-cooperation of companies supplying medical and health goods and equipment with Iran, and disrupted purchase of drugs for rare and acute diseases. Sanctions on the aviation industry and aircraft parts have also seriously endangered the safety of Iranian passenger planes, while the lack of access to the international financial system and refusal of foreign companies to accept foreign exchange guarantees issued by Iranian banks have put additional economic pressure on bread earning.
The loophole, or what the United States has seen as a loophole, was that because it involves economics, it's not actually war. And this is complete crap. You know, I mean, this is medieval war. Not only is it warfare, but it's medieval siege warfare by other means. It killed 500,000 children in Iraq. It's killing people in Iran.
Iranian women, and led to a decline in purchasing power of the elderly and problems for people with physical and mental disabilities in accessing medicines and medical equipment, adequate care and rehabilitation.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
For the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic through to 2021, China's growth was always positive and greater than that of the United States. China's policy not only saved lives but protected the economy. One might say, win-win. We're prepared for you an article written by John V. Walsh. Until recently, a professor of physiology and neuroscience at the University of Massachusetts, Chan Medical School. The piece is titled COVID Death Toll versus China's Puts US to Shame. May and June, two milestones were passed in the world's battle with COVID-19 and were widely noted in the press, one in the United States and the other one in China. They invite a comparison between the two countries and their approaches to combating the pandemic. The first milestone was passed on 12th of May, when the United States registered more than 1 million total deaths due to COVID-19, the highest of any country in the world. WebMD expressed its sentiment in a piece headlined, US COVID deaths hit 1 million. History should judge us. Second, on 1st of June, China emerged from its 60-day lockdown in Shanghai in response to an outbreak there, the most serious since the Wuhan outbreak at the onset of the pandemic. The total number of deaths in mainland China since the beginning of the epidemic in January of 2020 now stands at 5,226 as of 19th of June 2022. To put that in perspective, that is 3,042 deaths per million population in the US versus 3.7 deaths in China due to COVID. 3,042 versus 3.7. Had China followed the same course as the US, it would have experienced at least 4 million deaths. Had the US followed China's course, it would have had only 1,306 deaths in total. The European Union did not fare much better than the United States, with 2,434 deaths per million population as of 19th of June this year. When confronted with these numbers, the response of the Western media has all too often been denial that China's numbers were valid. But China's data have been backed by counts of excess deaths during the period of the pandemic, as the New York Times illustrated in a recent article. Actually, this is old news. The validity of China's numbers, as shown by counts of excess deaths, was validated long ago in a February 2021 study by a group at Oxford University and the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This was published in the prestigious British Medical Journal and is discussed in detail in the United States. Clearly, China put the saving of lives above the advance of the economy with its dynamic zero-COVID policy. But contrary to what was believed in the West at the time, saving lives also turned out to be better for the economy, as shown in the numerous data from the World Bank. During the first year of the pandemic, that is 2020, China's economy continued to grow, albeit at a slower rate. In contrast, the US economy contracted dramatically, dropping all the way back not simply to 2019 levels, but to pre-2018 levels. Interestingly, the plot also shows the year that the Chinese gross domestic product based on purchasing power parity or PPP surpassed that of the United States in 2017, heralding a new era for the global South. The World Bank has not yet released data for 2021, but the International Monetary Fund, IMF, has purchasing power parity gross domestic product data for 2021. The U.S. economy grew at 5.97% compared to China's 8.02%. Unlike the World Bank data shown in a graph for the years up to 2020, these data for 2021 are not corrected for inflation, which for 2021 ran at 4.7% in the United States, whereas China's inflation rate was 0.85%. So China's growth would be even greater in comparison to the United States, where inflation taken into account. Bottom line is that for the first 2 years of the pandemic through to 2021, China's economic growth was always positive and greater than that of the United States. China's policy not only saved lives but protected the economy. One might say win-win. Is China's dynamic zero-COVID policy sustainable in the face of the Omicron variant? The period of the recent Shanghai lockdown, which we can date from 1st of April 2022, ending on 1st of June, and followed the second largest outbreak in China since the original outbreak in January of 2020 in Wuhan. Each resulted in major lockdowns. The first in Wuhan lasted about 76 days, and the second lockdown in Shanghai lasted about 60 days. The first in Wuhan was due to the original variant, and the second lockdown was due to the much more infectious Omicron variant. During the recent lockdown in Shanghai, the Western press was awash with proclamations, all too many laced with the unseemingly schadenfreude that China's dynamic zero-COVID policy was not sustainable. This is all too reminiscent of decades of predictions that China's extraordinary success in developing its economy to number one in the world in terms of purchasing power parity, or PPP, and gross domestic product GDP was a passing phase, a Ponzi scheme that was, what else, not sustainable. Recently, the same press has gone silent, always a sign that China has met with success. So what are the results? The Shanghai lockdown ended on 1st of June this year, and from that day until the day of this writing, 19th of June, there have been no deaths due to COVID-19 on the Chinese mainland. Cases nationwide are also way down to 183 per day from the peak of 26,000 on 15th of April. That was the largest number of cases in a single day for the entire period of the pandemic in China. For comparison, the peak in the United States was 800,000 in a single day. Both the Wuhan and Shanghai lockdowns demanded sacrifices and patience over the roughly two-month period for each. However, these difficulties are generally exaggerated in the West and based on anecdotes of the worst of the difficulties encountered. Such sordid journalism reaches rock bottom in a New York Times piece equating China's hard-working healthcare workers to murderers. As an antidote to this kind of hit piece and to gain a feeling of life in the cities that were under lockdown during the Wuhan outbreak, Peter Hessler's March 2020 account in The New Yorker, Life on Lockdown in China, is enlightening and will dispel many misconceptions. Peter Hessler was living and teaching in Chengdu in Sichuan province at the time. China's approach has succeeded, and the public health measures that have worked so well in mainland China should not be lightly dismissed, let alone be the subject of mean-spirited attacks. Such measures may be means of saving millions of lives when the next variant or the next pandemic strikes. Turning again to the United States, what does it say when one of the richest nations in the world, spending more than $1 trillion a year on its national security budget, could not muster the means to deal with COVID-19 and ended up with more deaths than any other nation on Earth? China's handling of the coronavirus pandemic certainly shows a completely different outcome was possible. The US death toll was not an inescapable act of nature. That being so, should there not be a people's tribunal to investigate those in charge of the US government over the course of three administrations. That is what's needed, not an official whitewash. And should not punishment appropriate for a crime against humanity be meted out? The 1 million dead Americans deserve no less.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya man bada'a khalqi wa dhikri wa tarbiyati wa birri wa taghdiyati habni libtida'i karamik wa salifi birrika bi ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi أتراك معذبي بنارك بعد توحيدك وبعد من طوى علي قلبي من معرفتك ولهج به لساني من ذكرك واعتقده ضميري من حبك وبعد صدق اعترافي ودعائي خاضعا لربوبيتك.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, this part of the Kumail supplication was under discussion. Ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi, my Allah, my master, my Lord, aturaka mu'adhibi binarika ba'da tawhidik. Can you be seen tormenting me with your fire after I have professed to your oneness? وَبَعْدَ مَنْ طَوَى عَلَيْهِ قَلْبِي مِنْ مَعْرِفَتِكَ After your cognition my heart has embraced, وَلَهِجَ بِهِ لِسَانِي مِنْ ذِكْرِكَ And the remembrance of you my tongue has constantly mentioned. وَاعْتَقَدَهُ ضَمِيرِي مِنْ حُبِّكَ And the love of you to which my mind has clung. وَبَعْدَ صِدْقِ اعْتِرَافِي وَدُعَائِي خَاضِعًا لِرُبُوبِيَتِكَ After the sincerity of my confession and my supplication, the humble before your lordship. Since in this excerpt of the Kumail supplication, the words qalb al-damir and of course the word hub is used, the place of which is nowhere but inside the heart, we started discussing cognition of the Almighty Allah and true cognition only happens inside the heart of the servant. And this is what prepares one to turn toward Allah and receive His mercy. Because in our narrations, we have seen some traditions that highlight the importance of availing the moments of the softening of the heart. And when one is brokenhearted as a result of the hardships and distresses in this world, for turning toward Allah the Exalted through prayer and request. This is what we have seen a lot throughout our traditions. Now, one might wonder, what is the secret behind all this that these moments make the servant receive Allah's mercy? The secret might be lying in the fact that the heart cannot acquire the state of turning toward Allah and that of receiving the mercy, except when it softens. So the acquisition of the state of turning of the heart and that riqqatul qalb is really necessary for the one who desires the fact of Allah, and for the one who wishes to attain the state of turning toward Him during the prayers. Let us have a look at one interesting tradition. Ishaq bin Ammar narrates, I said to Abu Abdullah Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, it so happens that I supplicate and desire to weep, but I cannot. At times I remember some of my family members who have passed away, so my heart softens and I weep. Is this allowed? He alayhi salam replies, yes, do remember them, and when your heart becomes tender, do weep and invoke your Lord, the Blessed, the Exalted. This is the importance of riqqatul qalb in bringing forth the Almighty Allah's mercy.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity? And despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity, no, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah,
now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, dear listeners, when Imam alayhi salam says, وَعَتَقَدَهُ ضَمِيرِ مِنْ حُبِّكِ, means this belief must happen inside the heart that has been softened beforehand. This state of heart, this state of qalb, is so important that if the state of weeping did not give the supplicant a helping hand to soften his heart, then he should simulate weeping, what we have in our traditions as a tabaki, because this results in weeping, and weeping in turn results the softening of the heart, which subsequently brings forth the mercy of the Almighty Allah, and it opens up the heart of the servant toward Allah. And now he is closer to the station of mercy and rahmah. And interestingly, this is also what has been asked from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. It is said that one asked Imam Sadiq, I only simulate weeping when I supplicate, and I cannot weep. So there is only simulation. And Imam alayhi salam says, there is no objection in it. Yes, there is no problem with that. So overall, we can say that the more humble the heart becomes, the closer supplicant will be to the response. And this is what leads the supplicant to say, وَبَعْدَ صِدْقِ اَعْتِرَافِ وَدُعَائِ خَاضِعًا لِرُبُوبِيَتِكِ, after the sincerity of my confession and my supplication, the humble before your Lordship. I mean, Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that if one believes in the vastness of the mercy of you as the absolute cause, this cannot happen. To see you tormenting such a servant with your fire after he has professed to your oneness, after his heart has totally embraced your cognition, after he has sincerely believed in you, after he has brought forth his sincere supplication, and he has turned his heart humble. And on the contrary, the harsher and harder the heart becomes, the further the supplicant will be from the response of his supplication. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
African researchers have been warning about monkeypox outbreaks for years. As vaccines are deployed globally, they worry they will be left behind. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Max Kozlov, researcher. This article is published under the heading Monkeypox in Africa, the science the world ignored. Stay tuned for more. After monkeypox cases exploded last month in countries such as Portugal, Spain, and the UK, where outbreaks don't usually occur, a rapid global response followed, including distribution of vaccines in some countries. But monkeypox outbreaks have been occurring in parts of Central and West Africa for years, leaving African researchers there disheartened that such resources have not been made available in their countries, where the disease toll has been highest. They point out that they have long been warning of the potential for the monkeypox virus, which has been behaving in new ways to spread more widely. So far this year, there have been more than 3,000 confirmed monkeypox cases in countries beyond Central and West Africa, but no deaths have been reported. In Africa, however, health officials have reported more than 70 deaths that they suspect were caused by monkeypox. This is probably an undercount because of limited testing and surveillance capacity, says Dimi Ogaina, an infectious disease physician at Niger Delta University in Amasoma, Nigeria. Although he is frustrated by monkeypox having been largely ignored by Western nations until now, Ogaina worries that the current global outbreaks still won't improve the situation for Africa, he says. If we don't draw the attention of the world for this, a lot of solutions will address the problem in Europe but not in Africa. Before this year, only a handful of monkeypox cases had been observed outside Africa. These were linked to the importation of animals from continent or to travelers who had visited. The largest of these outbreaks was a short-lived one in the U.S. in 2003, which stemmed from imported animals and made more than 70 people ill. Meanwhile, some African nations have been dealing with monkeypox outbreaks ever since scientists identified the first human case in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1970. Although researchers still don't know precisely which animals naturally harbor the virus, they do not know that it circulates among many species of rodents and can transmit from animals to humans. A significant outbreak began in Nigeria in 2017, with more than 200 confirmed and 500 suspected cases of monkeypox. Over the past decade, the DRC has seen thousands of suspected cases, as well as hundreds of suspected deaths. In Central Africa, the strain of monkeypox virus that has infected people is more virulent, with a mortality rate of about 10%. For Adelosa Yinka, an epidemiologist at the Nigeria Center for Disease Control in Abuja, the current global outbreaks have brought on a certain sense of déjà vu. Before the 2017 Nigeria outbreak, the virus seemed to be confined to rural areas where hunters would come into contact with animals. It would make its presence known with a fever and distinctive fluid-filled pox, lesions on the face, hands, and feet. After 2017, she and other epidemiologists warned that the virus was spreading in an unfamiliar way. It was appearing in urban settings, and infected people sometimes had genital lesions, suggesting that the virus might spread through contact. With the virus now proliferating in Western cities through what seems to be close contact, the world is paying the price for not having responded adequately in 2017, the epidemiologist says. At the same time, researchers have been warning that cases of monkeypox in sub-Saharan Africa have been rising for years. In part, this is because countries stopped giving people vaccines against smallpox, which is caused by variola, a virus that is closely related to the one causes monkeypox. Smallpox was eradicated in 1980 and vaccination was halted, meaning that the percentage of the population vulnerable to it, and thus to monkeypox, has been growing. Since that time, some nations have maintained national stockpiles of smallpox vaccines because health officials have been worried that labs keeping samples of variola might accidentally release it or that the virus might be weaponized. Countries including Canada, France, the UK and the US have been using these stockpiles in a ring vaccination strategy to protect close contacts of a person who is infected with the monkeypox virus. Steve Ahuka, a virologist at the University of Kinshasa, says these vaccines would be useful to tackle the outbreaks in Africa, but countries there don't have large stockpiles, and Western nations haven't donated their shots for use against monkeypox. Both Ahuka and Yunka Ogolunu, scientists, say that if they did have vaccines, they would at the very least recommend inoculating frontline healthcare workers and lab technicians. Other researchers Nature spoke with also said the shots could help to curb monkeypox in Africa if they were given to people with compromised immune systems and those who frequently encounter wildlife.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.